for the love of language.
For the love of language. For the love of language.
Tonya, Kate, words. What are words? Are they the actual building blocks of language? We think they are.
Certainly they're the most interesting to people, it seems to me, and people tend to, when they think of language, they think words, that's it. They're the most accessible part of the language for people, and I think also they're fascinating because they're tied so much to the social and cultural life of the speakers. That makes them endlessly fascinating because they go on interesting journeys and they tell us interesting things about past attitudes.
Where they've been.
Exactly.
And they're tradable.
Oh, yes, easily moved between languages. Crystal has that gorgeous description of English as being like a gigantic linguistic vacuum cleaner because it just sucks up words from all over the place.
Tonya, in podcast number one in this series, we talked about denotations and connotations. Mm. Let's dig into that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
When we try and define what a word is, and it may or may not be the building block of language because we're going to be talking about things like phonemes later, which mm-hmm. are smaller units of sound, but is that definition that we find in the dictionary really a rock-solid definition of what a word does?
The way that words come and go in language has an awful lot to do with how they're used and how they're used in context. And that means that whatever the context is has quite a large bearing on how a word is understood. And that gives you lots and lots of scope to fiddle with the edges of the meaning of the word. I think it was Bollinger who said something about meanings that hang around like hungry flies.
Yes. Dwight Bollinger is one of my favourite linguists, no longer with us, unfortunately, but he was around 1970s, 80s. He talked about meanings that are inside and central, and then he talked about meanings that are inside and peripheral, and then he talked about meanings that indeed hover on the outside like a pack of hungry flies. And he was trying to get across this idea that words aren't these tight little bundles of form and meaning that we think they are. So people are always saying, you know, what's the real meaning of gay, or what's the real meaning of whatever, as if it has only one true meaning. And we tend to think that the meanings that we grew up with and the meanings that we're familiar with are the true meanings, but of course that's not the case. And those packs of hungry flies that hover on the outside are ready to come in at any time and become part of the central meaning.
That's true, Kate, of almost any word, isn't it? I'm just thinking of a really simple basic word like box.
Mm. Yes.
As you start examining the word box, it slips away from you a bit.
It does. Another nice image of Dwight Bollinger's was as slippery as wet soap in a bathtub to describe words. Indeed, and dictionaries try to put the words into the soap container, but they slip out again. And even, yes, and as you say, a word like box can be used in all sorts of different contexts and metaphorical contexts. You know, I'm boxed in or something like that.
Are those flies that Bollinger talks about, are they the connotations?
Yeah, I think that's how you get away from the core dictionary definition of a word and into other spaces is through context and through the kinds of implicit and implied meanings that attach to words through the way they're used in context.
In the flow of language.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or in written language.
Yeah. And I think there's probably some different pressures and possibilities in spoken language compared with written language, because in spoken language, the person that you're talking to is there with you. And so you've got a fair bit of scope to be adventurous because you're negotiating the meaning together. And if things fall apart, you can repair. When you've got written language, though, you're projecting yourself into the future and into the mind of a reader who's not present. You have to take different kinds of risks in writing than the possibilities that are there in spoken interaction. I think it's because people can exercise quite a lot of conscious choice over words that they become very visible. It's a lot harder to exercise conscious choice over the minutiae of grammatical rules.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons why people get very exercised about their personal favourite rule. And it's also a lot harder to have conscious control over the way you pronounce words, which certainly anyone who's learned a second language will know from personal experience. Some languages, which are called polysynthetic languages, manage to squeeze a huge amount of meaning into a fairly long word. So effectively, a proposition that in English would take maybe half a dozen words and make a sentence can be expressed in some other languages in just one word.
Give us an example of that.
One of my favourites is West Greenlandic, which has a single word for something like, admittedly, it is currently agreed that we have a licence to go out fishing sharks, something like that. But that's all done at the level of the word. So what's really interesting is that there are real-world meaning, lexical meanings that are not handled by sort of freestanding forms, but by affixes, prefixes, suffixes, etc. There's not much in the way of syntax in these languages, putting words together in different ways.
A lot of that happens in the word.
Happens at the level of the word. So clearly the idea of what is a word in West Greenlandic is very different from what is a word in a language like English. And it's sometimes what drives students mad when they come and do linguistics and they come thinking they've got a pretty good idea of what a word is. And of course people do. Then they try to define a word linguistically, you know, what's a word? And then what's a word across languages? Before you know it, you've got a whole lot of different criteria for defining words. There are whole conferences being put together on what is a word, and students get a bit cross because they thought they knew what a word was.
So one of the things I think is quite interesting about the relationship between words and grammar, and really also words and the sounds that are used to express them, is the way that you need a certain amount of complexity to get meaning-making done. And in some languages, the investment in complexity happens very visibly at the level of the word. So that would be true for West Greenlandic. In other languages, there's a lot of really visible complexity at the level of the sound. The languages of the Pacific Northwest are famous for having enormous sound inventories. And in other languages, you end up with the sense that a lot of the complexity in language is at the level of the grammar.
So, Tony, going back to the idea of choice and I guess implicitly creativity, because we talked about that in podcast number one in this series, that words are really vital, a really vital element in being creative in language.
Yeah, when you think about the way that things are put together in language, you can sort of almost think about it like a food pyramid in a way, where you've got lots of little things that you combine, lots of sounds that you combine into words that may have other kinds of parts in them like inflections. And then the words themselves you build up into sentences. And there's a limited amount of conscious choice in relation to the sounds and the way that they're expressed as words. There's lots of choice about the way that you put the words together. And then there's rules that kind of constrain the way that you put the words into sentences. So one of the ways that you have choice about words is that you might have a family of synonyms for the same or related concepts, and then you make choices within that.
Whether I was sloshed or inebriated last night, yes.
That's a good example.
The English language has something like 2,000 expressions for drunkenness. Wow. That is an area of rich lexical creativity, yes. And some of them are buttressed by beautiful sound symbolism like sloshed and smashed and plastered.
Kate, as we look at the history of words and their evolution and their continual change, we perhaps even can say continuous change with usage, which ones change most easily? The concrete words, the abstract words, words that describe things that are much more ineffable? I'm imagining that concrete words would hang on more easily than the ones that are a bit more wafty. Is that right?
Well, what happens over time typically is that the concrete ones become more abstract with time. That seems to be a pretty universal of semantic change or meaning change, that concrete words become abstract and abstract words become more abstract. Not only that, they become more and more centred in the world of the speaker, more subjective.
So, for example, a word like back, you have your own physical back on your body.
Yes.
And then that becomes the back of objects around you. And then it becomes a direction. And in some languages, eventually, it can become a preposition. So that's becoming more and more abstract and less and less connected to your physical body.
What is the power of being a word then? Because we know in German, for example, and even in English, we use hyphens to put individual words together, like ice cream and words like that. In German, you can stack a whole lot of words together to make a new word. One that caught my attention when I was in Germany, I've mentioned to you before, was in advertising, Reinwaschkraft, which I don't know how you translate that, something like deep down cleansing power.
Yes.
Something like that.
But we can do that too. I mean, in fact, compounding, putting two or three or four words together is a very common feature of Germanic languages generally, and German is a close relative of English. But you're quite right, German tends to write them solid as one word. And well, English has never figured that out. You gave the example of ice cream. I've seen ice cream written three different ways. Mm. So ice cream can be written
as two separate.
It can be written with a hyphen, or it can be written as one word. Now, we've had ice cream, as far as I know, since the 1600s they've been making ice cream, and we still haven't figured out exactly right. Because there's a kind of rule of thumb, the longer the word's been in the language, the more inclined you are to write it as one word. But in fact, when we say the word ice cream, that's what's sometimes known as an oronym, because it could also be I scream. As I think Pinker put it so beautifully, we actually hallucinate the word boundaries there. They're not there at all. It's just one continuous stream of sound.
What is the power of being a word, linguistically?
when you've got a word and it's a conventionalized string and everybody's a bit familiar with it, what you're doing is you're just sort of poking the listener's brain right in the spot where the word is stored, and it all comes at once. So the advantage of something that's established as a word is that it's almost like a shorthand. It triggers all of the meanings and associations in a fairly conventionalized way. Whereas if you've got something that you've just built new out of a string of words, or if it's a compounding sort of creation in German, the listener has to do all of the work of unpacking what that meaning is.
And earlier you talked about redundancy, and that's where you do, in fact, get a lot of redundancy in these compounds like oak tree. What's an oak tree but a tree? You know, you don't really need the tree. Or you get some gorgeous aspects of redundancy with those blended constructions. So you talked about compounds, but you also get blends where you get two or more words kind of squashed together, like chillax is a good one as a recent entry into English, and that's chill and relax. So they're two words that actually mean the same thing, sort of glom together to make one word.
We're talking about words, but are proper nouns, and particularly names, are they a special case? I've got a very old friend called Potter. His surname is Potter. When I think about him as Potter, I don't think of him as a person that might be throwing a pot on a wheel. It takes on a different form in my brain. Are place names and proper nouns a different form of word in a way?
Oh, well, sometimes they have different grammatical rules associated with them, and certainly in English they have different orthographic conventions because you capitalise them.
And they are just like an extension of the person, aren't they? Mm. And that's why they do behave differently grammatically. They can be magical. I mean, you have know someone's name, you have power over them. That used to be the thinking. Think of Rumpelstiltskin. Say the name of the wolf and he shall come running, you know, the name of the devil, etc. They are magical things. For some languages, names are like body parts or shadows, or they're an essential part of the body, and they behave very differently grammatically.
Let's go back to this division, if we can call it a division, between spoken language, which is a very bedrock of our language, and written language, which came much more recently. Alphabets only a couple of thousand years ago, the Gutenberg Revolution much more recent. We talked about words fatiguing, dying, returning sometimes, zombie words, if you like. Which is more influential, Kate, on that process, the spoken language or the written language?
The last 300 odd years in the English-speaking world, certainly writing has been taken centre stage, hasn't it really? So if something is there in writing, it does act a bit like, I don't know, formaldehyde and keep these words going, and then they have a certain clout because they're part of the written language and that keeps them going.
I think that written language is also interesting because of the way that it can be a word generator. People do exciting counts of all the words that Shakespeare invented, and maybe he didn't actually make them up, but he was the one who wrote them down, and once they were written down and people valued those texts.
And that's celebrity endorsement too, isn't it? That Shakespeare used it. He used the verb to dog, which had been around in the language for a while, and then he uses it and all of a sudden it takes off.
It's legitimate now.
Yes, yes.
And also he made it memorable.
Yes.
In a beautiful piece of verse or...
Yes, most certainly. But he must have had a wonderful ear for the slang at the time, wouldn't he? And just... Because I think you're right, Tonya. I don't think he could have invented 1,700 words or however many he was supposed to have invented, because I don't think his plays would have been as popular as they are. Or his,
that's a good point.
You know, he reaches people, and therefore I think he must have had just a great ear for the language of the time. Mm.
You said earlier, Kate, that we're immersed in various forms of written or notated language, if you like, ways of putting the language somewhere else, away from our bodies and away from our voices. Is that process now that we're so immersed in, particularly in the internet age with texting and all that sort of thing, which has oral aspects to it, doesn't it? What we text now almost feels spoken in some ways. Is that influencing the change of language more than just oral usage in many ways these days?
Rates of change don't have to be constant. There are times of kind of speeding up and times of slowing down. And we are actually coming off the back of a period of fairly slow change because of written language, the power of written language, the fact we've got dictionaries and grammar books, and that kind of keeps the spoken language in line. And now, yes, that's right, we've got the internet, we've got electronic communication, and in a way, well, some linguists have put it this way, speech is breaking free again. It's not tied so much to the anchor of writing, and therefore we are living in interesting linguistic times, and change is speeding up, particularly now, yes, with the internet, because, you know, 2 hours, they've got global take-up. It's really hard for dictionary makers, I think, to know when to put it in the dictionary. There are thousands and thousands of new words indeed created all the time. So how do we explain the ones that survive? Best example of that, I think, is the word okay, which must be about the most successful word of all time.
But sounds do play a role, don't they? Rhyming and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, rhyming, I think, is very important. That the sound of something, people love the sound. I mean, there's a whole lot of websites devoted to the most beautiful words or the favourite words, and people just love the sound of it. Serendipity, I think, was voted, you know, word of the year because of the way it sounded.
So we are talking about such a thing as a euphonious word, aren't we? Mm. A sound. We talked earlier about arbitrary signs, that words are arbitrary for their meaning, but somehow now we're talking about a sound that conveys something extra. Yes. How is that possible?
People looking for this relationship between the way a word sounds and what it means, and people read into that and see, yes, certain sounds then do start to have meanings.
Is that a musical sensibility kicking in a way?
We talked earlier about the morpheme being the smallest meaningful unit in a language, like prefixes or suffixes or something like that, but then you've got these things called phonesthemes, which are smaller than the unit of the morpheme, which are these either single consonants or vowels or clusters of them, or could be rhymes.
Give me an example of that.
Oh, so something like the ump phonestheme in English, so like hump and mump and clump and bump.
Dump.
Yes, so they sound heavy. Or the odge, you know, stodge. It just sounds big and lethally fattening.
Are we just imagining that? Is that just a cultural overlay or is that real?
Well, I was thinking about the snot ones.
Yes.
So sneeze and snore and snuffle and, you know, I think there probably is something a bit sort of oral and nasal about a snot.
And it sounds kind of nasty too, doesn't it? But yeah. Snow doesn't. It doesn't. So it's not across the board, is it? So it doesn't have that regularity that the morpheme does. It's a kind of sub-regularity, I suppose. Mm.
Can I raise the word metaphor? Because this is fundamental, I think, to the way we use language and this transformation of words and the way they bounce off with new lights. They're very prismatic in a way. What can we say about metaphor and the way words and language generally, I guess, Kate, work?
Well, some would say all language is metaphoric. And that certainly does seem to be the case, that when you sort of scratch the surface of words that you just take for granted, there's a hidden or a dead metaphor there. You know, a really good example was something I think I said earlier, something about grasping. You know, grasping is
a physical act.
Physical act, that's right. And yet we use it for understanding or understand, standing under. There are these metaphors that are just part of language and even part of grammar. So I'm going to do that, I'm going to. Is it, you know, movement in space becomes movement in time. That's a metaphor.
You can't have your cake and eat it too with an idea like metaphors, right? So if we say things are all very metaphorical, then that means that there's quite an important kind of reliance on context that can become fixed over time, but it's always still there. So what something means for one person isn't necessarily the same as what it means for everybody else.
And those analogies we use all the time in our communications with people around us are like propositions. Mm. Sometimes they fly, sometimes they don't fly.
Analogy, I think, has been described as one of the most powerful forces in language. And then that's what a metaphor is, isn't it? You're taking a word and putting it into a different, or an expression and putting it into a different context. And, you know, you might be trying to shed light, or you might be trying to be playful, or whatever you're trying to do with that language.
And coming back to the idea that it's a joint activity, spoken language, when people are making those metaphors together and playing with language in that way, it's such a pleasure. People, you can see how much enjoyment people get out of those kinds of interactions where they're jointly making something fun or beautiful out of language.
There's this interesting research that's just come out that shows that learning a new word and the meaning attached to that new word actually does stimulate those pleasure circuits in the brain. That's the same as, you know, the pleasure of eating nice food or gambling or sex, and words are there stimulating exactly those same parts of the brain. We love words. We play with words. We create words all the time, like lexemania, which is the mania for creating new words.
Until next time. For the love of language.